Scouts. Three little Cub Scouts, hogtied and left in an Arkansas ditch. And three teenagers, enamored with satanic rituals, arrested. It made headlines all over the country, even becoming the subject of three HBO documentaries called Paradise Lost.
In a statement given to the police and obtained by a Memphis newspaper, 17-year-old Jesse Miskelly allegedly confesses to watching two other suspects choke, rape, and sexually mutilate three West Memphis second graders.
The murders had been part of a satanic ritual.
Satanic worship.
A horrific ritualistic sacrifice.
We're just sitting on the couch watching TV the night we were arrested.
They had to find somebody to pin this on. This club list was getting out of hand.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clemente, former New York City prosecutor and retired FBI profiler. And today with me is...
Laura Richards, criminal behavioral analyst, advocate and author and founder and director of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service.
And I'm Lisa Zambetti. I'm the casting director for Criminal Minds, and I have a real interest in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes.
Well, today we're going to be starting a series on the documentary series called Paradise Lost. First version of it is Paradise Lost, The Child Murders of Robin Hood Hills. This was a very disturbing, brutal, triple homicide of three young boys. And their names are Christopher Byers, Michael Moore, and Stephen Branch. These three boys are going to be the focus of our discussion, and we will take you through this case as it is portrayed in the documentary series Paradise Lost, 1, 2, and 3.
So yeah, we're going to use the framework of the documentary to talk about it. This is such a confusing case. It's such a controversial case. You know, I thought when we were doing the Meredith Kircher murder and we're talking about Amanda Knox and the camps that are sort of believe that she's innocent or guilty, I thought that was a controversial case. But oh my goodness. Our listeners have really let us know where they stand on this case and what became of the defendants. So there's so much to talk
there's
about.
There's a lot of emotion there's driving lot, what
yes.
happened.
So we're going to try to be very neutral. And, you know, as we go through these actually four documentaries, because we'll also do the West of Memphis documentary that came out fairly recently. But there's just I'd never heard of the West Memphis Three. I mean, I heard the name, but I thought it was like a indie country
really?
Rock band or something. Like, I didn't know that it was a case.
And I heard about it from John Douglas.
Yeah, please.
Yeah, I mean, you said that, Lisa, the West Memphis Three, but I certainly hadn't heard of that title. And obviously that denotes the defendants. And I certainly hadn't heard the young boys' names either mentioned before. And I think that's very true, actually, in the UK. I don't think many people have actually heard about this case or know much about West Memphis as a place, where it's located. And so it'd probably be helpful to do that. But I think, you know, it's an important part for us, as all of our listeners know, to go back to the basics, the story behind the story, which
right.
is what happened to the three little boys, to Chris, Michael, and Stephen. Talk about, you know, the crime scene and some analysis from that before we even get into anything about the who did it part.
Right. Well, these boys were 8 years old, and they lived in a small town called West Memphis. It's actually in Arkansas. Now, Memphis, Tennessee, which is on the east side of the Mississippi River, is a very famous booming town, and there's a lot of great food and amazing jazz, and Elvis even hung out there a bit.
Well, that's where I would have heard of it from, Elvis
yeah,
Presley, and
of course.
The home of FedEx as well.
Oh, wow, I didn't realize that. But West Memphis is in Arkansas, and it's a much smaller town, and it's certainly, well, the only thing that put it on the map is this case, this horrific triple murder of 3 8-year-old boys. We need to really get into some of the victimology here, because I think ultimately that is going to tell us much more about who committed this horrific crime or these horrific crimes than a lot of the emotional,
echo chamber, which has just, you know, been permeated and promulgated. The fiction has kind of become fact over time, hasn't
absolutely.
It?
And talk about confirmation bias. We'll get into it, but we basically see in this case where they sort of made conclusions at the beginning, and then only looked at evidence that they thought pointed to that. And it never leads to a just ending. It always causes confusion and very likely misdirection of an investigation.
I had a question for you, actually, Jim C. Mm-hmm. So during my research, I read about, obviously, West Memphis, and it's a town of about 30,000. So, you know, relatively small, close to Oklahoma, Texas, Louisiana. And it basically said, you know, in one of the documents I read, that it gained notoriety for being the highest murder rate in the nation. Is that something that rings true with you? Oh. I thought it was Baltimore, you know, for a long time.
Well, I think 3 out of 30,000 is 1 out of 10,000. This case, in and of itself, is what made it the highest murder rate in the country. So 1 out of 10,000 people were killed in that year, right?
In 1993, this was. So May 5th, 1993.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm sure that in the other big cities that have very high crime rates, they have millions of people, so the murder rate is not 1 in 10,000. You know, it's probably 1 in 100,000. So that's why this was so highly rated. It's such a small town, and to have a triple murder in a tiny town like this, of course, it turned the town on its head.
Not the thing you want to be put on the map for.
Right. But let's talk about that, because the town is part of the victimology. And when you have a small town like this, when you have, you know, in rural Arkansas, people tend to be pretty open. They all know each other. They're all pretty much, neighborly and neighbors. I'm sure there's good side of the tracks and bad side of the tracks, and there's people that are troublemakers and so forth. But
you were posted to Arkansas, weren't you?
I was.
At one point?
I have to say, I've driven through West Memphis a number of times to get to Memphis from Little Rock. Because
and your thoughts?
Well, I mean, it's just all I remember is it being a tiny little bump on the map, and that's really it. There wasn't really anything dramatic there until, of course, this case happened. And this happened actually a year, just about a year, almost to the day before I was stationed in Little Rock for the Whitewater investigation. And so I was there in Little Rock for about 15 months. And because Little Rock wasn't much bigger than West Memphis, Little Rock didn't really have a lot of attractions, nothing really to do much except maybe go fishing and hunting if that's what you're into. And I wasn't. Although I did play a lot of golf there. There was a lot of access to sort of, you know, golf courses and tennis if you wanted it. But I would often go to Memphis with other people from the investigation whenever we got a break, and that's when I drove through West Memphis.
And when did you first become aware of this case?
I heard about it in the news at the time because, of course, you know, it was a triple murder of three little boys. And immediately what I remember from the news was that that they arrested a very strange kid who was supposedly into devil worshiping, and it sounded like he and a couple of his friends had committed this murder, and that sounded really horrific. Of course, later in my career, I guess 1998, when I became a profiler in the behavioral analysis unit, I was then brought up to speed on some other facts in the case, and we'll get to that later. But even later than that, John Douglas got involved again in this case, and he did a really comprehensive behavioral analysis of this case with all the information that they knew at that time, and I thought that was pretty significant. Again, we'll talk about that when we get to that chronologically.
I mean, this is a case just, you know, knowing that John Douglas was involved, and obviously you discussed it at the FBI as well. I mean, it just seems sort of rich for, you know, a proper behavioral analysis of it, even present day. And, you know, there should probably be a team looking at this, right?
Well, we are. That's what you and I are doing, Laura, and Lisa will help us.
Can you guys just tell real quick who John Douglas is for people who don't know?
Well, it's probably best coming from Jim, seeing as he worked closely with him, and I have too, but go ahead, Jim.
Well, John Douglas is the most famous profiler He certainly was critical in starting the behavioral science unit and actually becoming a unit in the FBI, at the FBI Academy, that assisted local law enforcement across the country and eventually around the world in strange, bizarre, and serial homicides and rape cases. Typically, they started with cases that were unsolved, and they did behavioral analysis, and they're the ones that made it actually a legitimate law enforcement tool that other law enforcement agencies across the country and around the world could rely on. And of course, that's how you and I met, Laura, when Great Britain was basically starting up their CEOP, Child Exploitation and Online Protection Behavioral Analysis Unit. And so I went over and helped train them and work with them for a couple of months, and that's when I met you.
Right, and in 1996, I was at New Scotland Yard, and we were setting up a behavioral science unit, mm-hmm. as it was called, the BSU, which then morphed into the sexual offences section. But we were very much taking the model that John Douglas and others had set up in the FBI, because New Scotland Yard felt that they should have their own behavioral profiling unit.
Right.
Because obviously London being, and the Metropolitan Police being the largest police district, meant that we had, I would say, a large volume of crime, but certainly having worked at both New Scotland Yard and FBI, I would say in terms of violent crime, we had, you know, nothing in terms of the volume of cases that you were exposed to working in the behavioral analysis unit at Quantico.
Well, yeah, I mean, just by the sheer size and population of our country, it has to be greater. But we do have a lot more violent crime here in the United States than you do in London. And we certainly have much more gun violence here. I mean, just outrageous. One of the things it's a slight side note here, but I will say that I was taken aback because when I was in London, living there for a couple of months, that it seemed the major crimes that they were dealing with were knives. And kids carrying knives to school and knife attacks and stabbings and things like that. And I said, wow, that sounds like 1950s United States of America. And I remember that one kid was arrested because he brought a knife to school, he said, to protect himself because other kids were threatening him with a knife. And I remember saying to myself, somebody should tell that kid, you don't protect yourself from a knife with a knife. You protect yourself from a knife with a chain. Because, you know, that's actually a way that you can, you know, disarm somebody who has a knife. But anyway, I remember it being dramatically different than the crime problem that we have here.
Spot on. I mean, you're right. That's always been the bigger problem. We actually had a homicide prevention unit group. I remember talking to you about this working group on knife crime and gun crime and another sort of 12 other portfolios that I ran. And I remember us having that exact conversation, mm-hmm. that you don't duel with knives, but we have much stronger and stricter laws and sentencing around guns.
Right.
But I think, you know, going back to the profiling side, I mean, John Douglas really sort of, you know, wrote the book, if you like, on behavioral profiling. And he started a new process of interviewing serial killers and, you know, looking for trends and patterns as well as the behavioral profiling. And, of course, people like Robert Ressler and Roy Hazlewood and some of the...
Right.
Ken Lanning, the big greats.
Yeah, and Dick Ault and Roger Teaton. You know, of course, we lost Roy Hazlewood last year and Ed Sulzbach, two of the great, you know, legendary profilers, both of them really good friends of mine. It is very sad, but, you know.
I remember being taught by him in Scotland, actually, in Tally Ho.
Really?
You know, and a complete legend. I mean, in our world, mm-hmm. you know, the sort of the celebrity and the grandfathers, really, you know, the absolute giants.
The icons,
in this field.
Yes.
Yeah, and, you know, many of them are published. And, of course, John Douglas has written many books as well. Yeah. And, you know, he was one of your mentors for a
right.
time, I think. You know, you work very closely with
yeah.
him. So, and now we're hearing a lot more from him because he's involved in Hollywood as well
yeah.
with one of the big projects that we're allowed
right.
to say what
I'm
it is.
I'm sure we can. I mean, I think it's been advertised. It's with Charlize Theron and it's called Mindhunter. And so we're really happy for him about that. We can't wait to see that on the air.
I think it's going to be amazing.
Right. But I think I failed to mention, and I should also mention, Robert Ressler passed away as well, and he was another great profiler and another father of profiling. So it's been a rough couple of years for the retired FBI profiler crew.
It has. It's very sad, but I think the important thing is that they felt so strongly about their learning, you know, the learning part and teaching, that they invested heavily in that side, didn't they, Jim? Mm-hmm. Like doing the circuit and training a lot of law enforcement. I was privileged enough to have met many of them. And in fact, at your retirement, Jim, I also remember up at the FBI, you know, I was sat on tables just with, you know, some of the legends as well. That, yeah. You know, these are fantastic and real thought changers, and their legacy does live on. I mean, it lives on through those that they've touched.
Right, and the next generation, and the next generation. Yeah.
Which is important too. And the more that we learn, of course, we build its building blocks. But John Douglas did play a key role in this particular case.
Which I was going to ask you, though. He came aboard the case kind of much later after there'd been convictions. But the FBI did not get involved in the beginning of this. And I'm just, there was a listener who had a question about that.
Well, I don't think they did, but they might have been in some advisory capacity. But
they arrested the defendants fairly quickly, and given that it was a single state, they probably—I mean, I don't know—you would know, Jim, but
yeah,
they probably didn't feel that they needed the FBI at the time when they moved so quickly.
And I believe the critical point was that the boys were reported missing, not abducted. And then they were discovered very shortly thereafter. And so it's a local homicide case, a triple homicide, but a local homicide case. So the FBI would not have any kind of primary jurisdiction because it didn't go across state lines.
And the detectives, as we saw in Paradise Lost One, you know, we heard them being questioned, or the senior detective, and he was very confident that they had the right people. You know, he was asked on a score of 1 to 10, how confident are you in your case? And he said 11.
Yeah.
So why would they, in that state of mind, why would they need to bring the FBI in? So, of course, it's only when time goes on, I would think that, you know, a number of people felt that they wanted the best in the business. And that's why people like John Douglas, you know, and we'll talk about, you know, each of the documentaries, but of course someone that Jim and I know well, Dr. Werner Spitz, who's also called in as well, in, you know, right at the end stages, because this case obviously spanned, I think it's 18 years, isn't it? So it's a very long time.
You know, Jim and Laura, so many listeners are very interested in the West Memphis 3 case that we're covering. They really can't get enough of this topic.
Yeah, it's a compelling case, and several documentaries and feature films have been made about it. And many books have been written about the subject.
But you know what? There's so much out there, you can hardly find time to read it all, especially when I'm trying to research a case like this. But now there's a whole new way to enjoy books on your favorite topic. The great thing is you can listen anytime, anywhere on Audible. And right now you can try it for free by texting the word Audible to the number 28325.
That's right. There's really nothing like hearing a book read by the author. And if you're interested in the West Memphis 3 case, you can hear Damian Eccles read his book, Life After Death, himself for free by texting Audible to 28325.
Audible content includes an unmatched selection of audiobooks, original audio shows, news, comedy, and more from leading audiobook publishers, broadcasters, entertainers, magazine and newspaper publishers, and business information providers.
And the great thing is membership includes one free audiobook a month, plus exclusive sales, 30% off regularly priced audiobooks. And unlike other streaming services, with Audible you own your books, which for me is great because I love to keep going back and forth and looking at my references. So it's a fantastic resource to refer to time and time again.
So get a free trial membership now by texting the word Audible, AUDIBLE, to the number 28325. Again, text Audible to 28325.
It was 1993. The three second graders are found drowned in a ditch in West Memphis. It was before Arkansas could handle DNA testing, no physical evidence to link the teens to the crime.
They were the unusual kids in town, dressed in black. They listened to heavy metal music. They were goths before goths were fashionable. And so they were easy targets.
So shall we just go back in time to 1993 and talk about the start of this documentary? And do you want to describe how it starts, Jim, or do you want me to, or
yeah,
Laura?
Go ahead. Why don't you?
So We have to say right off the bat that this is an incredibly graphic subject and documentary. And when you first see the very first scene in this documentary is the crime scene footage of somebody in law enforcement taking a video of the crime scene. And there's no way to describe what you see in that first scene. You think you're just looking at a ravine and a little creek, and you think you're just looking at a pile of leaves. And as the camera zooms in, you realize it's not a pile of leaves, but it's a dead little boy. And then they zoom across to the other side of the creek, and you see two other dead children. They're not blurred out. They're not in any way altered.
And I have to say,
how did you feel about that?
Well, I was deeply disturbed by that. I mean, it's a crime scene where three children were killed, and they're showing their completely naked bodies in full view to the world. And I just don't know why that happened. I don't know why they didn't use black bars to block out the faces and the genital areas of these boys. It's just, to me, unconscionable. Why would they do that?
It seems very gratuitous. I agree with you, Jim. I mean, it seems completely gratuitous and sensationalist. And, you know, it begs the question for me that the cameras, you know, going in, the HBO sort of style and being right in from the start is a very interesting concept in 1993, that they get access to everything, or whether that's the actual crime scene footage itself.
Yeah, that's not their footage. That's the law enforcement footage. That's not their footage.
Right, but
so they're giving access to it. So that's the point that I'm making. Mm-hmm. Whoever shot it, that's one thing, but being given access to it and it going on mainstream TV, you know, it's quite a rare thing to see a full... you know, the full body, and particularly these are children. And, you know, there's no such thing as child pornography. It's child sexual abuse images. I mean, this just seems very gratuitous. And it's things that Jim and I are used to seeing. But the caveat, I'm afraid, just did not cover it, because it said, you know, it's graphic content for young viewers. It wasn't for young viewers. It should have just been, you know, for everybody. And actually, was it necessary at all?
I think it was. These filmmakers obviously made a very strong choice that is not easy to make. You know, that's something that you really have to talk about. How are we going to start the film, right? And for me, after I watched it, it was so hard to watch, but I'm glad that I saw what I saw, because this entire case obviously is about this crime, but not just these. It's about the way that these children were found. It's that they were found naked, that one appeared to be castrated, that this is what it is, people. This is why people in this town are going absolutely crazy, because they're perceiving it, this crime, not to just be any kind of murder, but to be a specific kind of murder. And so to see it, this is what it is, I felt was a very bold move, but it propelled me through the entire rest of the film. I had those little boys in my mind, and it put them first. It put them, this is what happened to me.
But you could have exactly the same image in your mind without seeing their genitals, without seeing their face. It's not necessary. You're going to see a picture of them, the happy snaps of them, in 2 seconds. But there's no reason for them to have exploited those children. If it was, and it's the same thing if they do it to a woman or an adult man, but it's even more exploitive. We protect our children more. And I don't understand, and I believe that they took advantage of the family's lack of sophistication and that the fact that they didn't immediately sue to get those images taken off, because they're not public images. They're not something that needed to be put out in the public airwaves forever. And those kids lost their privacy.
Dignity and respect. And that's important. You can't unsee what you've seen. And I can certainly say there'd be hundreds of thousands of people who switch off because they just cannot deal with that kind of content. It's the reason why, you know, Jim and I and others, you know, we're trained professionals. We have to look at that stuff, and it takes its toll on the professionals too. But putting it into mainstream TV and people switching off because they can't deal with it, or it stays with them in terms of a trauma, you know, you can obviously deal with that material. But I just don't think that caveat covered it. I think it was disrespectful and gratuitous, and you will never be able to unsee what you've seen. And that will stay with people.
We don't know. I don't know if the parents did or did not give their permission for that to be shown or not. And some parents might be like, well, there was a woman, one of the Sandy Hook mothers, who lost her son. She wanted people to see what had been done to her son. Like, this is what it is.
Yeah, but I'm sure that if her son was naked, she would have wanted him to be covered up. And that's how you – wait. There is actually law that mandates that you do that. In other words, if I am a law enforcement officer and I'm going out to train law enforcement around the world, I have to cover up. If I'm showing images of children, I have to cover it up. I have to cover up their genitals. As a law enforcement officer, why did HBO get a pass on that? Why did they have to show? And it's not once. It's repeatedly over the course of this series. And it is the most disturbing, as you call it, a choice, a bold move, but I call it criminal. I call it disrespectful. And I don't know what the motivation was behind that. Was it tabloidy? Was it they thought they're going to grab more viewers by doing this? I don't know. But either way, they did not protect the dignity and the rights of privacy of those children. And I believe their families had, if not then, maybe still now, a cause of action against HBO for doing that.
Well, how could you continue to watch the documentary then if you felt so strongly about the first scene?
Because I watched the documentary to watch the documentary. I've seen hundreds of thousands of images, as bad or worse.
That this really turned you off to the filmmakers, that you felt like they're exploiting these children.
It did.
So doesn't it muddy?
I didn't pay the filmmakers to do it, to see it. I saw it, you know, on YouTube.
No, but you know what I mean? Like, wouldn't you just judge the rest of the film as being exploitative? And
well, I didn't. I told you they did it repeatedly. So every time they did that, I thought that it was exploitive. But I wanted to see what the content was. I mean, we're talking about it. It's our responsibility to find out what is out there before we talk about it. And the fact is that both Laura and I have had to view images like that and worse. And so it didn't affect me the way it might have affected you or the average person who viewed it, but it pissed me off more because this is the kind of image that I spent my career preventing from being on TV, preventing. Do you understand how many hundreds of thousands of people who are sexually interested in little boys could view that and get off on it sexually? That's why we
will.
Yeah,
of course, but they'll get off on anything.
They won't. No.
This is Jim's area of expertise, actually.
I understand that, but you're not saying that they...
They won't get off on anything. They'll get off on naked images of children.
These filmmakers, you know, just deliberately put this out there and didn't give a shit if people were getting off on it. You're talking about porn. I mean, you're talking about children being shown in other ways than this.
Right. No, I'm talking about this. Do you understand that people who are sexually attracted to children will use images that may not have been porn and turn them into porn?
Yes,
in other words, it's how
that.
They use it. It's not just the intention of the person who filmed it. So this was obviously a crime scene video that was then used in a documentary film or series. And at that point, I believe that they were criminally negligent in putting that stuff out. That's my professional criminal justice experience opinion. And I know that people who are sexually interested in prepubescent children, pedophiles, will enjoy this kind of material, use it to fuel their sexual fantasies about little boys. And even it will support fantasies about killing little boys. So on so many levels, it was wrong. They shouldn't have done it. It created a tremendous opportunity for really sick, bad criminals to take advantage of kids, and I'm never going to agree that it was okay.
And we've got to remember, we had Bill Thomas on here talking about his sister Kathy and how upset and irate he was about crime scene photos being used by a law enforcement professional and being shown and then being leaked. You know, for families, you know, it's a real abuse in the sense that their loved one is now being further victimized. And I agree with Jim in the sense that just these families in particular, when this happened, how would they know, you know, what to respond to or how to respond to the media? And you can see how clumsy the media were to them just in some of the interviews, which we know we're going to get into. So, you know, they wouldn't know what rights they had either, I'm sure.
I think they took
advantage of small
town.
And they probably signed everything away, you know, knowing that this hoping that it was a force for good. But this is 1993, isn't it? We're kind of going back, you know, way back in time. And certainly HBO had full access to everything. I was surprised by that, I have to say. The courtroom scenes, for example, and you can see how people adjust their behaviour because of the cameras, you know, and some people grandstanding, playing up to it. You can see those adjustments, which in a major trial or case like this, it biases things and it distorts and it changes things with further complications.
When the detective was testifying about a knife that he got, that he received, he said, yeah, I got it from the HBO guys. And you could see him looking up and he's kind of a little embarrassed.
That I felt definitely, that for me crossed a big line for me. And we can talk about that.
Well, they crossed that line for us a lot earlier.
Right from the start. But I guess, you know, the thing to say that from the perspective of us having eyes on and first-hand source material, primary source about the crime scene, in terms of a professional aspect to it, of course, it shows us things that we wouldn't be able to understand just from reading notes or reading reports. And that's why Jim and I always say, you know, a picture paints 1,000 words, but going to the scene paints 1,000,000. And it also told us a lot about the whole way the scene was managed or not, as the case may be, in terms of, you know, what was happening with law enforcement and how it was being treated and managed. And I think that's another important part when we get to crime scene assessment.
So do you want to just talk about, you know, setting aside the right or wrong of it, showing it to the public? When you look at that crime scene, and we learn lots of things about that crime scene in later documentaries, but when you look at that, what struck you when you were seeing that footage?
Well, I mean, the first thing for me, I've got to say, is, well, who were these little boys? You know, and that's the thing that we would start with, the victimology. So, yes, you're seeing images, but you instantly want to know, how are the three connected? You know, how old were they? You know, were they friends? Did they hang out together? Was this, you know, what kind of area was this in relation to their homes? You know, did they meet someone somewhere else and then they're brought here? How did they get to that place?
Right.
And so right from the get-go, you see two bikes, don't you? But I think it's probably important for us to say something about each of the boys first, about who they were.
Victimology, yes.
Yeah, the victimology before we get into the crime scene assessment. And so some of the things that, you know, I learned just by doing some of the research is that they were friends. They were 3 8-year-olds.
And it does take the documentary a while to get to all those details. Like they don't give it to you right up front, because I remember taking notes saying, wait, you know, all kinds of questions came to me long before that was ever answered.
Yeah, that's right. But I guess if, you know, we're understanding it in terms of we want to, A, put this, you know, our perspective, center the victims straight away, you know, who they were. And that's something that Jim and I would look at. You know, we wouldn't just go out to a crime scene and not have any information at all about what it is and who it is, you know, that we're seeing. We want to understand everything about them.
Right. So, yeah, the case started as missing kids. So these three boys are missing. They didn't show up back at the house when they were supposed to be there. You know, there's some questions about where they went, where they were going, what they were doing, and so forth. And then within, I think it was within 24 hours,
reports of them being missing that evening.
Right.
And I think it was, you know, they were meant to be back for tea time and they weren't back for tea. So there was a report to the police. And they were obviously missing persons at that point, but juveniles, not having gone missing before. And I think one officer was then sent to the families and they started searching, but nothing happened. It was just one officer searching with the families, and the families had to call again the next morning to ask what was happening and why wasn't there a search team out helping them search for the three little boys. So that kind of struck me as an interesting point, that the, you know, the wrist markers, the alarm bells weren't really ringing, but they were found the next day, as you said.
Right. And so today we know, and hopefully most law enforcement agencies know, that the first hour is critically important. And I believe that these boys were probably killed within the first hour of them going missing. But 44% get killed in the first hour of kids who were abducted and killed, and 73% in the first 3 hours, and 99% in the first 24 hours. And so waiting a day to actually turn this into a serious hunt for these boys was a definite law enforcement mistake. and they should have raised the alarm immediately, and it should have been an all-out effort looking for these kids, because a few things could have happened. One, they might have actually saved them, or two, they might have preserved a crime scene that was not well preserved, even within 24 hours. We'll get into that in a little bit.
Yeah, and I mean, these are the cases, Jim, that you've, you know, spent most of your career working, right, yeah. As a profiler.
Yes, yeah, child abductions and child abduction homicides. And certainly there's indicators that are interpreted originally as sexual assaults on these kids, or at least one or more of them. And so, yeah, those are all cases that fall within what I developed an expertise in, and many of the cases that I worked over my career.
So the information just about the three little boys that I managed to find was that they all achieved the rank of wolf in the Cubs. You know, that they were in the Scouts.
Yeah.
And that was a big deal for them. And in fact, one of them, Michael, loved the Scouts so much he would wear his uniform outside of going to going to the Scouts. And that tells you a lot about him. And he was the leader of the three, apparently. And he had a 9-year-old sister, Dawn, as well. But they went to Weaver's Elementary School, and Stevie basically was really loved the Ninja Turtles and learned sort of karate chops and moves the same way as the Ninja Turtles. And he had a pet dog and a turtle. He was an honor student, and he too had a stepsister called Amanda, who was 4 years old at the time. And then Chris Byers, who we hear a lot about, much more than the other two, I felt, you know, across the Paradise Lost one, was described as being quite hyperactive and quite a curious child. I don't know if that's a euphemism for, you know, he was a bit of a tearaway and had too much energy. But, you know, his mum described him as being a typical 8-year-old boy. And, you know, he loves going swimming. And he also had a 13-year-old stepbrother, Sean. So I think it's quite interesting, just the family dynamics.
Right. Yeah, it is something that, as a viewer, you have to really pay attention to whose parent is whose, because there are a lot of step parents and half brothers and sisters. And so, you know, it is a community that is a very blended, lots of blended families and a lot of people to keep track of. I was wondering if it's significant at all that in this town, it seems like, you know, kids at this time in 1993 are let to kind of roam around, you know, unsupervised and do their thing and come home. Very loose rules, it seems.
Be
like.
Home for tea.
Yeah. So I'm just wondering if there was a delay in law enforcement getting involved because, they probably just, there wasn't a lot of alarm at first. Whereas in other communities, if somebody is 5 minutes late getting home, there's immediately, where are these people?
Well, I think, part of it has to do with the fact that these families were not tied into law enforcement. They were on the lower end of the socioeconomic scale, and they didn't have a lot of interaction in a positive way with law enforcement. But also, law enforcement should have the wherewithal to understand. And when a report of three boys going missing happens, then they should be following up on their own. And when dark comes, and when it's 10 o'clock and a midnight and 1 in the morning and they haven't been found, they should be raising all sorts of alarm bells themselves. And it's just a very, very dangerous situation, and they should have recognized it, and they didn't. And
the parents were saying, you know, that it was abnormal and they felt that something really terrible had happened. And of course, you know, we know that there are high risk victims and, you know, These are all the things that you look to. And Jim's for most of his career, you know, helping in terms of putting together the good practice of what you should do in this sort of situation, what law enforcement should be doing. But it was only the next morning that the BOLO went out, to be on the lookout for these three little boys. Mm-hmm. But it sounded like, from what you could see in the docu, that a lot of people did fear the worst from very early on.
Right. And you mentioned these kind of blended families, and that's actually a risk factor when there is a non-biological father figure in a situation, it is a risk factor for children who go missing. And there are a number of cases in which that non-biological father figure will actually take out a kid that is not his own flesh and blood, and that is something that I would have had my ears perked up for right from the start in this case because of the family situation.
And not just going missing, I mean also for domestic violence and sexual abuse. It's something that we have to look closely to straight away, and of course it's experiential learning as well from lots of cases.
In 1993, three 8-year-old boys were brutally murdered in a small town in eastern Arkansas. There is evidence the killings may have been part of a satanic ritual, but much about this awful case remains unclear. Today, we'll try to solve the remaining puzzle with the cooperation of experts and family members from both the young victim's side and the side of the teenaged accused. Pam and Terry are the parents of Stevie Hobbs. Stevie, one of the 8-year-old boys, brutally murdered.
Can we go back to the crime scene and talk about the area itself, first of all, of the Robin Hood Hills? I mean, firstly, it definitely looked very remote and very isolated. Until I looked at the map.
Right.
Which, when you look at the map, and I mean, I agree with you in terms of where they were actually found, you know, it kind of points to local knowledge in a sense to me straight away. But when I had the sort of the helicopter view of the crime scene, and you understand that it's sort of surrounded by, you've got the main service road, you've got a truck stop, and then you've kind of got the residential area on the other side, that it, you know, it's this kind of triangle of area, but in the middle of it, you know, remote and private in the sense that you could do, commit a crime like this without people knowing or coming across it.
Right. But so because of that, there's no official pathway through there or to there, really. But if you were local, you could use it to cut through to get to one of those places from one of the other places. And that's the kind of thing that is usually only obvious to somebody who actually lives in the area, spends time in the area. And so that's the first thing that would go into the characteristics as I build my profile on this, that it's probably somebody who's fairly familiar with this area that knows that this is a very private place and, you know, took advantage of that.
Or a place where the kids would play. I mean, you know, that was the other question. I mean, I have many, obviously, going through my head when I'm looking at it and trying to really focus. You know, it took me a while. I had to keep adjusting my eyes of what am I looking at here? You know, are they fishing rods? Were the boys there fishing? You know, it looked like there was something on the bank that looked like fishing rods and it wasn't. So what's the kind of kit that people have brought to the scene? Who's at the scene? Because we saw lots of different people kind of trampling around the place. And obviously there was a cut to a little bridge with two bikes on it.
Right.
So the next question is, well, two bikes, there's three boys. How close were the bikes to where they were found? You know, the geographical, well, the geographic distance. Did the boys get there of their own free will on the bikes or were they taken there?
Right. And I think that's one of the critical first determinations that had to be made. And, you know, the way I would do that is get the window of opportunity. What was the absolute last time they were seen? Make sure you do a comprehensive neighborhood canvas and roadblock canvases and repeat them on the next day, repeat them on a week later at the same time that they went missing to find out anybody who drives there, who's commuting and so forth, and make a determination as to what is the tightest window of opportunity that we could find. And then talk to them. Talk to their parents and their friends at school and neighborhood people and find out what the practices were of these kids. Did they ride around on two bikes where one rode on the handlebars or stood on the back?
Which we used to do as kids all the time.
Yeah. And or did only two of them have bikes and one of them didn't? Or did all three of them have bikes? Has one bike never been found? I mean, that would be critically important to me.
Or was there a skateboard, or, you know, got there another way?
Right. But, you know, clearly this area, it seems like it could be accessible by bicycles. Maybe they'd have to walk them to get to the actual place. But that bridge that you're talking about, it really seemed like it was
two pipes.
Yeah. Going across the river. And you would use it as a footbridge, maybe. But the critical thing to me is when we're looking at having the bikes at the scene, if these kids were killed somewhere else and brought to the scene, or even if they were beaten, assaulted, tied up, and then brought to the scene, if they were brought to the scene with the bicycles, that's a critical piece of evidence, because it takes space and time and adds risk to the offender if they bring the kids and the bikes. Why would they do that? So to me, either in cases that I've seen that happen where the offender takes the child and a bike, that typically is because if they left the bike would be right at the front of their house and it would indicate that they were the ones that did the crime. So that's the only kind of offender really that would have to do it. Some person from out of town would never have to move the kid and the bikes, because if they leave the kid's bike in front of somebody else's house, so
what?
It
doesn't matter.
They don't care. Yeah.
Great. It's a red herring. Police will go knock on their door. So that's one thing. The other thing is, you're talking about three kids. So one of the first things you'd be thinking was multiple offenders, because it's difficult to control three kids at once.
It's difficult to control one.
Yeah.
But two or three.
Right.
And
two bikes. Unless the kids got there on their own. In other words, unless they met somebody there or they were ordered to go there under their own power. And those are the two possibilities, I believe, that make the most sense in this case.
You're right. And certainly thinking about, you know, the sequence of events and the timeline aspect is absolutely critical in this case. Who, you know, it's the piecing together of when the boys were last seen and by whom and where. Were two of them together and then one joined? Then where are they last seen? At what point in time? And of course, there's a big window here. I think it's, you know, the 5 until 6:30 window, an hour and a half. And that particular time was never narrowed down. And it's only afterwards that you've kind of got people rudimentary kind of piecing together. You know, and some people weren't ever really interviewed or alibied, which again, in a case like this, you would expect everybody to have been spoken
with. Right. It's such an outrageous crime, and especially for this small town. Why wasn't it done? And it may be just because they don't have a lot of experience. The law enforcement didn't have a lot of experience investigating these cases.
That's probably what it boils down to, and hence, you know, devising checklists of things that, you know, when crimes like this happen, of making sure that law enforcement go through, you know, it's not just a tick box checklist, but absolutely making sure that they
right.
cover the ground from under their feet. Because in cases like this, my experience has always been, you know, where the children were last seen, that's where you go back to. And so many times people do not go back to that point, you know, and who else was around, who was seen at the time, particularly when you've got something that, for me, felt very local right from the start. And bearing in mind, I knew nothing about this
right.
case,
mm-hmm.
but I am seeing, you know, as controversial as it is about, you know, seeing those bodies, you know, we've just had that debate, but actually being able to see the locality, not necessarily, you know, understanding what happens. You only really understand that from the autopsy report, or having true experts interpret things in a professional sense
right.
and giving their professional opinion about what some of those injuries mean. But actually, Jim's just pulled out
the Child Abduction Response Plan pocket guide. So this is, you mentioned about instructing law enforcement having checklists. You mentioned about instructing law enforcement and having checklists of things to do. That's why we put together
golden hours
yes.
that you spoke about.
That's why we put together the Child Abduction Response Plan in the Behavioral Analysis Unit, and basically with it we handed out a pocket part which starts with checklists, and it is everything that you should do in the first hour, the first 6 hours, the first day, the first week, and so forth. And it gives law enforcement, and this is for first responders, it gives law enforcement a very detailed checklist of what they should be doing in order to make sure that they're getting comprehensive records and the investigation is being done. The right things in this investigation are being done at the right times, because if you wait too long, the risks of the child being killed and the risks of losing valuable crime scene information are just so great. So this book, The Child Abduction Response Plan, is available to law enforcement across the United States and actually around the world. So, and we have it in several languages as well. We've given it out, for example, in Spanish to Central America and so forth. Yes.
In your opinion, do you think that that happened in this case, that they, that all of that could have been done to these children? We haven't even really gotten into exactly the state that they were in. Could that have happened in that short of a time? Or is this something that you think took longer? Or,
and I think this is all going to be developed over the course of, as we discuss this, but I think that whoever, and this is one or more people, whoever had control of those kids must have been someone that was right there at that scene. I do not believe they were transported a great distance. I don't believe that that they had, much time. Usually what happens, and this is almost invariably, when someone has killed a child or children, or even adults, they try to distance themselves as much as possible. In this case, though, what happened? It was an attempt at permanent concealment. It was an attempt that took time to bind them, use a branch to pin one of the shirts down into the ground to keep the kid from floating back up, throwing the bikes in the river as well so that they wouldn't know, so that people wouldn't be searching in this particular area. In fact, it turned out that a sneaker floating is what actually alerted somebody. Otherwise, they would have walked right past it. So to me, that's an indicator that there's a known relationship between the victims and the offender or offenders. And I think that's a critical part in this case. I do not believe that the offender would have spent that amount of time trying to conceal these bodies if he didn't have some known connection, because he would be much more better served by distancing himself if there wasn't a known relationship.
And it creates further risk. I mean, the time spent, obviously creates further risk too. So, I mean, go back, Jim, to so the 44%. Let's just go through those statistics again, mm-hmm. and then get into the actual checklist of, what are the clear good practice points and what should they have been doing at which point in time in this particular case. So the 44% killed in the first hour.
Yes. So 44% killed in the first hour, 73% in the first 3 hours, and 99% in the first 24 hours. So unfortunately, law enforcement response in this case really was 12 to 18 hours late. Certainly the boys were dead long before law enforcement took this seriously, and that's really unfortunate. Not that they would have necessarily been saved, but the crime could have been solved and could have been a lot less controversial if they had recovered the bodies immediately. And so what we recommend doing immediately upon a first officer arriving at the scene, once they get a report of a child going missing, is immediately request additional personnel and get department supervisors to respond to the scene to assist in the initial assessment. In other words, in this case, they should have done that and interviewed all six of the parents and the additional two or three step-parents. They should have done that immediately. And so that they could have a solid assessment of what this case was. Was it an abduction? Was it children going, staying out and playing? Was it kids that are staying at some friend's house?
Running away.
Possibly. But how do they determine that? Well, the first thing is they verify the accuracy of the complaint information, all the basic facts about what, when, where, who, and why, and how, and a good, solid description of each of the children, and then determine the exact circumstances of the disappearance.
And recent photos.
Yeah, you know, well, that's...
Putting that out.
Okay, so then the first thing they want to do is verify the accuracy of the complaints information and obtain all the facts about who, what, when, where, how, including name and age and gender of the missing children, and an up-to-date description and clothing and any kind of possessions that they carried with them all the time. Of course, get a photograph, an up-to-date photograph of each child, determine the exact circumstances of the disappearance and the present custody status of the children, as well as any information related to vehicles that they may be associated with. If there are any suspects that are known at the time, of course, provide that information. Today, we would put out an Amber Alert with that information.
So the Amber Alert came from, it was actually a case, a little girl, Amber Hagerman, who on January the 13th, 1996, was abducted whilst riding her bike in Arlington, Texas. So that's really where the Amber Alert comes from.
Right. And so obviously it wasn't in place at the time of these crimes. However, it's actually become so common now that we get them on our mobile phones. And it's posted on electronics highway signs as well. And it's usually in a concentric circles radiating out from where the last known sighting is. And every hour, I believe, they go out 100 miles.
So, and it was critical. Well, obviously, as you said, it didn't happen in this case, but the details of Amber was that a neighbor who witnessed the abduction called the police, and Amber's brother, Ricky, went home to tell his mother and grandparents what had happened. And in this particular case, she was kept alive for at least 2 days, which obviously is quite a rare thing, but it all comes down to it being critical time periods, as you said, Jim, of getting information out there so that we can use the eyes and ears of the community, everybody, you know, who may have seen something. Sadly, in this case, 4 days after the abduction, near midnight, her body was then found in a creek behind an apartment complex, and she had wounds to her neck, so she had her throat cut. The site of the discovery was actually less than 5 miles from where she went missing. There were no suspects to her abduction and homicide.
Now it's a tool that's used to help kids who are abducted, and it's very effective. So the next thing that should be done is all the witnesses should be separated and interviewed separately and one-on-one, and their statements should be compared to known information. And investigators have to be very sensitive, especially in a case like this, because they'll be interviewing other children. And you have to really be concerned about the suggestibility of young children in this 8-year-old range. So that's something that all law enforcement officers should take into account when they interview children. The next three important things, really important things, secure the missing children's rooms, because they may be potential crime scenes and there may be information there that will help determine whether or not they ran away or whether or not they were abducted. Did they take their backpack and throw a bunch of stuff in there, or are all their things that they normally had with them in the room? Also, the last known location where the children were known to have been is also a potential crime scene, and that area should be protected until it can be properly processed. And then, as soon as practicable, notify your local FBI office to request assistance and resources necessary to further determine the nature of the missing child incident. That should all be done within the first hour. The FBI, with the Behavioral Analysis Unit, has child abduction rapid deployment teams in 5 or 6 areas across the United States. They can respond almost immediately to these kinds of cases and actually help share the expertise that we've learned over the years in studying all the child abductions that have occurred in the United States so that we can maximize the chances of getting these kids back and getting them back alive.
So that's the first hour. In fact, the UK did a very similar process, again, mirroring the lessons from the FBI, where on April the 1st, 2007, we introduced the Amber Alert system as well.
So I think we're going to have to just pause here until the next episode. There is so much more to talk about. And, you know, Jim and Laura, even though Laura and I have only recently heard of this case, so many people have dug into this case for the past over a decade. So mm-hmm. I know that there are people listening to us right now that are like, oh, but what? You know, I can just hear them in my mind because so many people know so much about it. Yeah, but you just have to wait and let our professionals, you know, unwrap this onion for us. So,
and also it's a good opportunity to talk about good practice as well. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's so important that when these cases happen that people understand, because we know lots of law enforcement do listen to the podcast,
right,
and they hear, you know, that we're not just criticizing or critiquing poor practice. There's actually, you know, we've been at the forefront of producing and developing and creating good practice, and we want to make sure that that gets out there, because right, these cases are really time critical.
And one of the good practices is carrying around the pocket part for the child abduction response plan. I've been retired 7 years now, and I carry it with me every day, even though I helped write it. I think it's incredibly important to make sure that every box is checked and everything that can possibly be done when a child goes missing is done. And the way to remind yourself is to carry this thing around. And they're free. Any law enforcement agency anywhere in the country or anywhere across the world can get them from the behavioral analysis unit.
And, you know, having develop the dash as well, I have to say I do the same thing, you know, with that risk assessment tool. Although I know all the questions, I develop the practice guidance, but actually, you know, you want to just refresh and go back. And when you're sat with a victim or a client, you actually want to make sure you're going through all the things that you need to. So it doesn't matter whether you're a seasoned, experienced professional with 20 years, you know, these are tools that really do change and save lives.
Okay. Well, we'll be back for more on Real Crime Profile.
Last week, we interviewed Vince Giacci, author of Mob Shot, and got great listener feedback. You can find Mob Shot by Vince Giacci on Audible, and Real Crime Profile listeners can get his audiobook in his voice for free with a 30-day trial membership by going to audible.com/realcrime. Again, that's audible.com/realcrime for Mob Shot by Vince Giacci.
So if you enjoy our podcast and would like to support us, there are a couple of important things you can do. First, you can go over to iTunes and give us a positive 5-star review. You can check out our sponsors and take advantage of the special promotions for Real Crime Profile listeners. You can go over and like our Facebook page, and you can follow us on Twitter. But most importantly, you can share our podcast with friends, family, and anyone you know would be interested in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes. So thank you for listening.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineered by Terrell Parham. Music composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107, or you can go on the website www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic violence, call the National Domestic Violence Helpline free phone 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, safety, shelter or counselling, call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, 214-946-4357, or go on their website, www.genesisshelter.org, or the domestic violence hotline on 800-799-7233.
So, Jim, what are you doing June 9th, 10th, and 11th?
I, like everybody else who's into crime, I'm going to be at CrimeCon. CrimeCon 2017 is Comic-Con for crime. Mm. Real Crime Profile will be there. We will be doing a live podcast from CrimeCon 2017.
So that's right. It's taking place in Indianapolis. Hopefully some of our Real Crime Profile fans can make it out and come
awesome.
To a live podcast. And there's a great lineup of people appearing.
My brother Tim Clementi and I will be hosting CrimeCon. We will be introducing all the different celebrities and speakers that will be there. And I think there's going to be some interesting people there because not only do we have Nancy Grace, but F. Lee Bailey and actually the prosecutor from the Making a Murderer case.
Oh, yes, indeed.
Mr. Kratz.
Yes.
Mr. Kratz.
Yes. It'd be very interesting to talk to him.
So check out the website www.crimecon.com and you'll see the whole schedule.
And our listeners can get 20% off the top on any tickets by using the promo code REALCRIME20. REALCRIME, the number 20. On top of that, if you go as a group,
they give you a further discount as well. So it's worth looking on our Twitter feed at Real Crime Profile without the E.
And we can't wait to meet you and talk to you and actually do a live podcast right from CrimeCon 2017 live.